Okay, welcome to Voices of the Middle East. This is Gudar Zaktidari, and another installment of our show tonight. We are kind of commemorating the 9/11 on the station and elsewhere. And tonight I have a very special guest, Chris Tonsing, with the Middle East Research Project. He's the editor of Middle East Report and executive director of Middle East Research and Information Project, NAREP. They put out different projects and articles, and they have a very useful media outreach that I have the pleasure to be on their list and get information about very sophisticated and distinguished guests that oftentimes you hear on them on this show, and that's pretty much because of the MEREP's work and providing that information. Let me welcome Chris to tonight's show.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's a pleasure to talk to you. We are 5 years after 9/11, and I would like to first hear what is your assessment of the result of basically a 9/11 on life of Arab Americans and Muslim in U.S., and then we will go to the region and discuss the issues that we have faced 5 years later.
Sure. Well, I think obviously the September 11th attacks were a tragedy of historical proportions and crimes against humanity of historical proportions. But I think that it's pretty clear at this stage that the response of the Bush administration to those attacks has made the world a more dangerous place than it needed to be, than it was before the attacks, and that the course that the administration took has, you know, very, very quickly squandered the goodwill and the genuine sympathy that the United States had in the world, including in the Arab and Muslim world, immediately after those attacks. Instead, the United States finds itself more hated and reviled around the world, and especially in the Arab and Muslim world, than it has been in perhaps its entire history, certainly in the last 50 years. And we also find that some of the self-declared objectives of the war on terrorism have been thwarted by the Bush administration's aggressive approach in declaring the attacks acts of war, in moving very quickly in with a very warlike posture, and then, worst of all, in subsuming the long-standing goal of the neoconservatives and their Cold War retread bosses, Cheney and Rumsfeld, and to overthrow the regime of Iraq, subsuming that goal under the rubric of the war on terrorism. All of these policies have made the world less safe, certainly made the region less safe, and have not brought to justice the primary architect of the September 11th attacks themselves, namely Osama bin Laden. And one wishes that the administration, rather than defining the attacks as acts of war and pursuing pursuing policies based on that characterization, had instead regarded them as acts of terrorism and crimes against humanity that might be dealt with through a much more careful and patient approach, perhaps combining law enforcement and some commando military operations that might have had a better chance of actually apprehending the planners and abettors of the attacks, and would not have caused all of the destruction that the actual policies the Bush administration pursued wound up causing. Just as one example, it's whatever the true number of civilian casualties in Afghanistan as a result of the U.S. bombing there, they were certainly in excess of the number of American civilians who were killed, who murdered on September 11th. And certainly the number of Iraqi civilians who have been killed as a result of the regime-changing war there and the everything that's happened since then greatly exceeds the number of American civilians who were killed. So this cost is very, very great, and it's been disproportionately borne outside the country. You mentioned what some of the domestic effects have been. I think the clearest effect of the attacks has been so far to strengthen a pre-existing agenda on the Republican right of creating the so-called unitary executive in the office of the presidency, namely strengthening the executive branch, and in particular the office of the presidency, vis-a-vis the other branches of the federal government, Congress, and the judiciary. And we see this in particular in Bush's policies on the legal front, the creation of a new category of enemy combatants that had no previous standing in international law, and the attempt to circumvent the checks and balances built into our legal system and our system of government to enshrine these new legal categories that they're trying to create in American law, even though they have been judged to be manifestly illegal and unconstitutional by the Supreme Court itself. This is playing out today in the U.S. Senate, with a few senators, including some Republicans, standing against Bush's attempt to have Congress essentially legalize ex post facto some of the interrogation techniques bordering on torture that have been used in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and the secret CIA prisons around the world. As far as Arab and Muslim Americans, certainly they were the community most directly affected by the attacks, in the aftermath of the attacks, with the FBI roundups, which resulted in not a single terrorism conviction or conviction on terrorism-related charges, but did result in a lot of people being detained without charge and incommunicado, unbeknownst to their families, for many months, and did result in a lot of people being deported unjustly, including for alleged immigration violations, which in reality were not violations because their paperwork was sitting in a warehouse in St. Louis unexamined by the relevant immigration authorities. So the effects of these attacks on both the international and the domestic front have been very far-reaching and mostly, I think, negative, unquestionably. And the real tragedy is that this did not have to be. The negative effects are mostly the result of very unwise and unduly aggressive policies pursued by the Bush administration, when wiser policies might have produced better results and would not have had these horrible collateral effects.
You differentiate between dealing with the 9/11 as a crime as opposed to act of war. And I believe you can probably give an example of how European countries like Spain and British intelligence had dealt with the bombing in London and Madrid. How can you compare the result of these two different strategies?
Well, clearly, I would say most of the successes in terms of apprehension of individuals responsible for acts of terrorism that can be traced to Al-Qaeda and similar groups have happened through law enforcement means. And that includes, by the way, the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993. And all three of the individuals who were involved in planting that bomb underneath the World Trade Center in 1993 were apprehended through law enforcement means. And that included cooperation of the FBI and other U.S. agencies with their counterparts in Pakistan. And it included just a lot of good old-fashioned detective work and a lot of good old-fashioned luck on the part of the FBI and other U.S. law enforcement agencies. But those successes, the arrest of Ramzi Youssef and his co-conspirators, happened through old-fashioned law enforcement techniques. And it's somewhat ironic that those are the very techniques that were so disparaged in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks as being outdated and useless in this new world in which we had allegedly traveled into with the attacks. And the same is true in Europe, where the successes after 9/11 have happened through law enforcement work, and the most recent example of that being the foiled plot, or at least the alleged foiled plot, to smuggle liquid items onto jetliners that could be made into explosives, and allegedly were due to blow up some airliners over the Atlantic Ocean. And that was British intelligence and law enforcement agencies working with American counterparts and other countries, and averting these attacks and arresting the people who were allegedly planning them, without resort to military means or the discourse of war. The interesting thing, Robert Dreyfus has a very interesting article in the current issue of Rolling Stone, of all places, in which he sat down with several serving and former counterterrorism officials in the Bush administration itself, and got a couple of them to go on the record saying that they're frustrated and actually resentful of the very term war on terrorism, because the very term war greatly distorts what their actual task is in trying to locate the small number of al-Qaeda types who really do have the intention and the wherewithal to harm Americans and harm people in other countries through acts of terrorism. But that this discourse of war actually makes it more difficult for them to do their jobs. And a man named John Brennan, who was the first counterterrorism top official after the September 11th attacks under the Bush administration, actually said that he thought that the persistence of the term war on terrorism and the fact that everything that's been done after September 11th under that rubric has been put under that rubric of war is more a function of the Pentagon's desire to sort of hog all the resources that were being thrown at prevention of terrorism and national security after the attacks. It has more to do with that than with a sensible, well-thought-out policy for actually preventing future acts of terrorism.
I just wanted to kind of quote one or paraphrase one of our, actually my personal good friend, Darius Rajali, who teaches political science here at Reed College. And he believes that one of the reasons of the using torture in either Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo has created a lack of participation from citizenry in reporting, and that's what is really missing in this case. Whereas in Britain, there are some individuals who were kind of came forward and gave information to intelligence because they did not feel that it's really going to be used as kind of torture. Even a brother apparently came in and gave link to his brother who was suspect. Whereas in our case, all the news that are coming from Iraq and the aftermath of 9/11 are indicating that alternative ways of interrogation are being used by the administration. Chris, could you give us some input on, you mentioned that we are being now more hated, or America is being more hated internationally and in the Middle East specifically. Do you have any data that would back up that? Is there any survey that shows this kind of change of attitude?
There are a couple of surveys that have been done by the Pew polling outfit. That's one of the more respected polling outfits. And there was one done in 2004, I believe, and then one done more recently. Both of those polls show that there has been a real deterioration in general attitudes toward the United States and toward Americans since the September 11th attacks, and in particular since the launching of the war in Iraq, although I suspect that these attitudes have a lot to do as well with the increasingly unstinting support for the policies of the Israeli government that has been offered by the Bush administration especially since the September 11th attacks, where essentially the right-wing government of Sharon and now its successor government were given free hand to act against the Palestinians in the occupied territories. On an anecdotal level as well, I've heard from lots of people, lots of friends of mine who have been traveling to the Middle East regularly, and I've experienced this myself in my travels to the region, that, you know, the old saw among Middle East studies people has always been that while American policies have never been terribly popular in the region, at least since the Eisenhower era, that the ordinary person on the street distinguishes between the American government and the American people, and that it's very rare for an American traveling in the region to encounter hostility simply on the basis of being American. That, I think, has changed. I think it is now more common to encounter that kind of hostility simply because you're American, and that is directly attributable to what the United States has done in that region and what the United States has supported in that region under the Bush administration.
One last question, Chris. How do you feel this administration is now moving? There are some signs of probably getting Iran involved in Iraq, or I don't know if administration is supporting that approach by Maliki's government, or also the latest trip by Kofi Annan to the Middle East and his talks with Iranians and Syrians. Do you see any anything developing in that side?
No, I don't. I don't see a major major policy shift on either the Iranian or the Syrian tracks. I thought that the Bush administration response to the attack on the U.S. embassy in Damascus the other day was quite striking in that regard, where although there were some appropriately diplomatic comments from Condoleezza Rice, Tony Snow, the White House spokesman, in response to a question about the fact that Syrian security forces had warded off this attack and that one Syrian guard at the embassy had been killed in this attack, Tony Snow's response was, well, the Syrian security forces did their duty, and now it's time for the Syrian regime to do its duty and stop supporting radical Islamism around the world and stop standing in the way of peace and so on. In other words, he turned the question right on its head and turned it into a rebuke of the Syrian government at a time when you would think that diplomatic protocol would mandate at least a display of greater gratitude for the Syrians awarding off this attack on a U.S. embassy. On the Iranian front, I think that the key factor at this point in time for in interpreting Bush administration policies is simply that the Bush administration has its hands tied by the ever worsening inferno in Iraq. And I think it is finally completely dawned on everyone in the Bush administration that the situation in Iraq is completely out of their control, and that all of the stratagems that they've come up with for dealing with it have proven inadequate, and that the problems are structural. It's structural to the setup of the new government. It's structural to all of the policies that have been pursued by the U.S. and its Iraqi allies since the fall of the old regime. And yet, on the other hand, pulling out of Iraq is not an option that would be considered by the Bush administration or by most people in the U.S. foreign policy establishment because of the U.S. interests that are at stake at the head of the oil-rich Persian Gulf. So I think that the Bush administration is certainly chomping at the bit to take an even harder line with Iran than it has taken. And yet it finds itself constrained by reality, by simple reality, against taking that kind of hard line, and even and therefore allowing a softer approach as pursued by the Europeans and as pursued by Kofi Annan to take center stage. That's for the time being. The worrisome factors, I think, with the Bush administration in Iran are the fact that Bush and Cheney do appear to believe that they are the only administration that's likely to have the steel nerve, if you will, to take an aggressive approach on the Iranian nuclear issue. They won't trust successor administrations to do that, and so that may be a factor pushing them into a more aggressive approach. The second thing is that they, as we saw this summer with the attempt to use the Israeli army as essentially a proxy for U.S. power in the Middle East to try and destroy or severely debilitate the Hezbollah militia in Lebanon as a way of taking away a putative Iranian weapon in the event of some kind of future confrontation between Iran and the West over the nuclear issue. Bush and Cheney have still not entirely abandoned this idea that that you can achieve far-reaching political objectives in the Middle East through the simple application of superior force. They still have the idea that that superior force always wins, even if it's in backing of policies that are completely rejected by all the major actors in the region and certainly by the peoples of the region.
There are some discussion right now or suggestion to kind of carve off Iraq in three different federal local governments in like the Kurdish in the north and the Shiite in the south and the central Sunnis. In your opinion, how does that play in the Middle East? Especially, I'm talking about the this comment by Kofi Annan on his trip to the Middle East that most of the leaders in that region, they all kind of mentioned that they believe that invasion of Iraq was really a blow in security and stability. How would this thing work if any time materialize?
Well, I don't think that the Bush administration backs that agenda at all. They very much want Iraq to remain territorially united, even if it's becoming increasingly clear that if Iraq will remain united, the central government will be very weak, and the regions, whether they're officially federal or not, will have a great deal of de facto authority. But I think that that's a point of unity between the U.S. and governments of the region that they want to see Iraq. They are committed to the territorial integrity of Iraq, and they're not thrilled about the strong federalism that would be ushered in if, for example, Abdulaziz Hakim and the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq succeeded in carving out an eight-province Shia super mini-state, if you will, in southern Iraq. I mean, that would be a real potentially destabilizing development in the region as a whole. It would certainly usher in an even worse phase of civil war in Iraq, and it would likely invite long-term intervention by other powers in the region, and that could escalate into a regional conflagration. The problem for the U.S. is that the centrifugal forces that are pushing the various regions of Iraq apart are built into the very structures, the very democratic structures that the U.S.-sponsored political transition itself midwifed and fostered, and that is, you know, primarily the wording of the Constitution that was passed in October 2005, which does allow for this strong federalism that is envisioned by Hakim and by the Kurdish parties in the north. And there doesn't seem to be the political will or perhaps the wherewithal to for the U.S. or the Sunni and nationalist parties in Iraq to force a serious reconsideration of those clauses of the Constitution. So, and you know, the U.S., since it is de facto backing one side in an ever deepening civil war in Iraq, and namely the side represented by the Iraqi government, the U.S. is kind of bet on that horse, and it's therefore sort of it's simultaneously for the territorial integrity of Iraq and for an inclusive and national government and all of those things. That's certainly the U.S. interest. And yet, the Iraqi actors that it is de facto backing have a somewhat different set of long-term interests. And that's a real contradiction in U.S. policy there.
Well, thank you very much. I was speaking with Chris Townsend. He's the editor of Middle East Report and executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project, MEREP. Thank you very much, Chris, for talking with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.